Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today.
It's Here and Now.
The three men who ran Freddie Mac, the company that owns or guarantees more than a third of all U.S. residential mortgages, are looking for work today. The president was fired, and the CEO and the chief financial officer resigned yesterday, amidst concerns about how little the company had been cooperating with federal investigators looking into accounting irregularities there. The shakeup prompted some investors in a housing market, which has been almost single-handedly propping up a sagging economy, to move their money elsewhere yesterday. Joining us on the line from Washington is Greg Ipp. He's a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Greg, and welcome.
Hi, Gail.
Let me see if we can kind of bring this down to all of us. What would have to happen here for this to affect general mortgage holders? I mean, clearly it's already affecting investors, but what about the rest of us?
Well, Gail, it's probably already affecting all of us in a very tiny way, even though it's difficult to measure. Let's start out with some real basics about how the mortgage market works. When you go out and buy a home, you need a mortgage, and you might go to your local Bank of America branch or your local Hong Kong bank branch, and they'll lend you the money. But they don't actually hold on to the mortgage once they've lent it to you. They will turn around and sell that mortgage in the market to an investor, and often that investor is Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae. These are the two gigantic federal-sponsored mortgage agencies. They used to be government-run, but now they're private enterprises. Now, that means it's very important to them that they be able to borrow at very low costs in the markets themselves in order to buy all those mortgages. When something disrupts investor confidence in these companies, that will force them to pay a higher rate at which they borrow. And that, in turn, means that they can only buy your mortgage when it's got a higher rate on it. Little bit by little bit, when these investor confidence issues start to seep into the market, it is going to seep all the way down to the end of the chain to the person on the street corner who wants to get a mortgage. And we've already seen that a very little bit. For example, yesterday we had Treasury bond yields, which are the safest type of investment available, go down a fair bit.
And historically, most investors have seemed fairly sanguine about Freddie Mac, you know, assuming that the government was not going to let it fail. How important is credibility, especially right now? Now in this environment.
Credibility is very important, Gail. I mean, Freddie Mac is one of those odd sort of animals, neither fish nor fowl. It does have this federal charter. It has a few privileges that ordinary private companies do not have, such as a line of credit with the Treasury Department, but it's owned by its shareholders. It's in business to make money. And yet, people who buy their bonds or buy their stocks are assuming that if things really, really got dicey, the federal government would not stand back and let this company fail. And that sort of creates this cloud of uncertainty over its exact prospects in the market. What if something were to happen that were to disturb people's assumptions about that? Then you could see these confidence issues sort of spiral out of control.
And how unusual are these accounting irregularities?
Well, Gail, the odd thing about Freddie Mac's accounting problem is that unlike most of the companies like Enron and WorldCom who were forced to restate earnings downwards, the end result of Freddie Mac's investigation here is that they will probably state earnings upwards. What's the problem, you might ask? Well, the issue might be this. According to people that we've talked to who are following the investigation, what Freddie Mac may have wanted to do was to hold down earnings in their really good years so that they could hope to boost them up a little bit later in bad years. And this would give investors the impression of a steadily rising stream of income, which is something that investors really want to have. And it's called a cookie jar reserve accounting. And it's something that the regulators frown on because basically it's not giving a true picture of the company's health to the markets. Now, the company says, no, that's not what they were doing. They thought they were following really good accounting practices that were approved by the previous auditor. Well, the previous auditor turned out to be Arthur Andersen, and we know all the problems they had with Enron and WorldCom and so on. And their new auditors, PricewaterhouseCoopers, say, this is not kosher. You have to do it differently.
So when the company says that the investigation isn't going to affect its overall profitability, are they on target or is that a little wishful thinking?
You know, Gail, the truth is we just don't know. They're going back over years of transactions, looking at this in very minute detail. Freddie has not been able to issue an annual report because their auditor is not comfortable signing off on their financials. If you can't take their earnings from the last few years at their word, does that force you to question all the things they say about their company?
Good questions indeed. Thank you so much, Greg.
All right, Gail.
Greg Ipp is a staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Well, for shareholders of the Xerox Corporation, news of that company's improper accounting practices in the late 1990s was bad enough. But now, insult to injury. Xerox announced last week that shareholders will pick up most of the $22 million in penalties levied by the SEC against former Xerox executives. Gretchen Morgenson wrote about this development in the New York Times recently, and she joins us now on the line. Gretchen, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure, Bill. How are you doing?
Great. Great to have you on Here and Now. Gretchen, you write about this Xerox situation as just the most recent case of failed corporate governance. How common is it for managers who mess up to not have to pay much or most for their own malfeasance?
Unfortunately, it's all too common, Bill, and the reason why is in the corporate bylaws at many of these, if not most of these companies, that requires that they have indemnification requirements, meaning that the company itself, a.k.a. the shareholders, must pay when the executives settle in a case like this one with the Securities and Exchange Commission. It is something that really has been flying under the radar among most shareholders. It was a shock to me, and I cover this stuff, so I think most people really don't understand that it exists. However, it's, as I said, just the last, you know, most recent lapse in corporate governance. And why on earth the shareholders should pay for the infractions of executives is beyond me.
How much will the six executives named in this Xerox case end up paying out of the $22 million in penalties?
Out of their own pockets?
Yeah.
$3
million. $3
million. So what we have to do here, Bill, if people are concerned about this, is get these corporate bylaws to be changed so that the indemnification requirements are eliminated. It's going to be tricky to do, I think, but it's really something that goes to the heart of holding people accountable for their behavior.
So what? How do you do that? Do shareholders just have to start writing letters and emails or marching around corporate offices on Sixth Avenue? How do you do it?
Well, a shareholder could conceivably next year at proxy season get a proposal onto the proxy that would require the indemnification to be either removed or to be changed so that it would not apply in such cases where there's executive malfeasance. This would have to be done probably by an institutional investor, a big, sophisticated investor, maybe a pension fund. But I think that if individual investors start rattling this cage, I think companies will start to listen.
Do you? How likely do you think it is that any of this will really change on a large scale?
I think that if enough people get irate about it, send letters to the SEC, send letters to the companies themselves, the boards of directors, I do believe they get listened to. I do believe they get read. I don't think they go into the circular file. These people know they're wrong, and they're very sensitive to it. That's a start. But I think that maybe writing to your pension fund manager, if you're, say, a TIA Cref shareholder, why not write to them and say, why don't you get this on the ballot? We think this is outrageous. They're typically a pretty activist shareholder and try to do the right thing. That may be one way to do it for small individual investors.
Just to finish up briefly, Gretchen, what's Xerox saying about all this?
Xerox says that they couldn't have done anything else because it was in the bylaws and because the executives were not found guilty, because they settled instead of litigated the matter, that it was absolutely a requirement. But I just don't think that that passes the smell test in this day and age. And if you've got people doing things wrong, they should have to pay for it.
Gretchen Morgenson, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime, Bill.
Gretchen Morgenson is a business reporter for the New York Times.
The election of Reverend Gene Robinson as the Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire was called a Holy Spirit moment by one Episcopal minister and a clear illustration of deep dysfunction in the church by the American Anglican Council. All this because Reverend Robinson is the first openly gay man to be elected to the position of bishop within the worldwide Anglican Communion, which includes the Episcopal Church. While Reverend Robinson's election has yet to be confirmed at a church convention in Minneapolis scheduled for later this summer, it is already sparking strong reactions from around the country. Joining us for more on the issue is James Rosenthal, Director of Communications for the Worldwide Anglican Communion. He's based in Canterbury, England. Welcome, James.
Thank you very much.
We mentioned a moment ago some of the reaction. I wonder what you're hearing.
Well, my email is full and to overflowing with, again, people with very strong opinions, both pro and con.
Can you give us a sampling of some of the strongest opinion you're hearing?
Well, I think some of the strongest opinion comes from organizations rather than individuals, where there is concern over various trends in the church, and especially theological trends in how one interprets the Bible. But again, some are saying it's a dreadful thing, and others saying it's about times. Others are saying it's time the church be honest, and others saying, you know, that this is the worst thing that's happened in ages.
Are you expecting to see many people leave the church because of it?
I think one of the things the church must face is that although people leave churches and leave congregations, and if Father X or Mother Y doesn't do what they like, they might go somewhere else, the reality is the church exists for the people outside its walls, not the people necessarily in the pews. The people in the pews are, by nature of who they are as baptized Christians, missionaries, and therefore our concern has to be for the people outside the pews.
As you know, the Episcopal Church in the United States has been torn over this issue for some 20 years or more. Do you see this as a vote for the greater inclusion of gay people into the church, or is this more about the work of this particular individual?
I don't know, Father Gene Robinson. Everyone who has talked to me about him says that he's a fine man and has done extraordinary, especially mission work in the Diocese of New Hampshire. It's a great diocese. The reality is gay and lesbian people are part of the church and all churches. And since 1971, I believe, in the Episcopal Church, there's actually been legislation to affirm gay people. And also in the Church of England in 1993, I believe it is, issues of human sexuality said that this is an inclusive church. The sticky matter is when it comes to the ordained. And the Lambeth Conference and indeed other church bodies have said that they feel it is inappropriate in light of tradition and light of Scripture that ordained persons be involved in active homosexual sexual relationships.
What's your best guess as to what's going to happen at this general convention on July 28th when the vote needs to be ratified?
I think that, you know, we have a history within humanity and even within the church, sadly, that when you look at racism, homophobia, all the sexism, all the things that have plagued us for years, and sometimes people can go to the Bible and find verses that actually support some of these notions. And I pray that whatever happens in Minneapolis, which I will be there, that I hope that it will be done in a spirit that upholds everybody, who they are, who God created, what they mean to each other and to the whole church, but in a way that is honest and always looking forward to the mission of the church and what it can do for a very weary and very, very untidy world.
James, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James Rosenthal is Director of Communications for the Worldwide Anglican Communion in Canterbury, England.
Just ahead, scientific innovation races ahead, but the law lags.
And later in the program, a family theater's unusual collaboration.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Former Reagan administration Treasury Secretary Donald Regan has died. Regan, who also served as President Reagan's chief of staff, was 84 years old. To read more, log on to our website, wbur.org. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Saunders Hotel Group's Lenox Hotel, Copley Square Hotel, and the Comfort Inn and Suites Airport, preserving the past while protecting the future. It's 1220.
Wondering what to get your dad for Father's Day?
I'm sure a lot of dads would be thrilled to get a Car Talk necktie.
Well, I know I would be.
Thrill your dad this Father's Day with a special tie from Car Talk. A $100 contribution for the news will get a silk Car Talk tie delivered in time for Father's Day. Order your tie online at WBUR.org or call 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Several years ago, Luann Buzenko was married and trying to have a baby. She and her husband, John, tried everything to conceive. They finally hired a surrogate to carry a baby for them. Shortly before the baby's birth, Luann's husband filed for divorce and claimed there had been no children from the marriage. But in fact, little JC actually had five sort of parents: the egg donor, the sperm donor, the surrogate and her husband, and Luann. The one person with no biological connection to the baby was the only one who wanted the responsibility of raising her. Luann's story and the legal and ethical dilemmas it brings to life is one of several told in Bloodlines, a new documentary airing tonight on PBS. And filmmaker Noelle Schwerin joins us now for a preview. Welcome, Noelle.
Thank you very much.
First of all, what drew you to this topic and also to this story?
Well, the topic, in a kind of a general sense, I'd worked on a film about genetic testing and was looking at some of the very complicated ethical and social dilemmas that fall out from these new technologies, and was very interested in some of the legal aspects and pursued that, looking at cases in the law in part because they're real cases, and a lot of people dismiss, you know, the sort of what's happening in this area as hypothetical, it'll never happen, and also because the law gives us a foil to kind of look at fundamental principles, the same fundamental principles underlie the law that, you know, we think of when we think about what's important to us. So when I started digging in that area, I came upon this case, which was stunning to me in the lower court's decision about what happened here.
And what was that decision?
The lower court said that the child, JC, had no legal parents. And I think that, to be generous, the trial judge, you know, was throwing up his hand saying, there is no law guiding me here, and expected it to be bumped up to appeal.
And what did the appeals court rule?
It looked to the intentions of the parties. It said, if it was your intention, only with your through your efforts would this child be in the world, then those intentions are what guide the law. So you will be held responsible for a child that you intended to bring into the world.
And that case led to another of the stories you tell, this one about a surrogate mother who was left with a just incredible dilemma when the parents who had hired her decided pretty much at the last minute they didn't want the twins that she was caring for them after all. And as we hear in the film, that came as a tremendous shock to Susan Ring.
I think there's a possibility for some couples to believe that surrogacy and egg donation, all of these new techniques that we have, are like a baby shopping type of thing. But they have to remember that when they create a life, they better be ready to take the responsibility with it.
Connect the dots for us, if you will, between those two stories, because other than the fact that both involve surrogate mothers, what do both these stories have to tell us about some of the broader legal issues here?
The attorney who was actually involved in both of those cases, Rob Walmsley, had basically created precedent with the Buzanka case in an earlier case of his, which meant that intended parents were considered legal parents. Then Susan comes to Rob, and the law that he had helped create meant that she had no rights. It gives us some insight into if intention is the guiding principle in the determination of parentage, which seems sensible in the Buzanka case. And if you couple that with an idea of reproductive rights, which the Supreme Court has recognized, is there any limit to what kind of, you know, situations can be created?
And it makes you wonder, how can it be that we are so medically advanced in the United States, and yet, as I understand it, the U.S. is the only technologically sophisticated country that does not have a policy for these kind of cases?
That's true. It's very unregulated in the United States. Americans, you know, feel strongly about their individual rights and are loath to allow people to regulate them, particularly around things like reproductive technology, reproductive rights. So without regulation, the decisions get made, you know, on the doorsteps of infertility clinics. And these are decisions that are not just about who has access to technology. They're decisions about what kinds of families we're going to save. What kind of society are we imagining, and what is the population that we're going to bring into that society?
It's the old question of just because we can do it, should we? I want you to also tell me the story of Jim Finn quickly, if you will.
Jim Finn is a remarkable man who has survived a very severe case of Parkinson's disease for many years, was essentially at the end of his rope, and his physician suggested to him that he participate in an experimental trial of something called xenotransplantation, where cells from an animal, in this case pig cells, fetal pig cells, were implanted in his brain in an experimental attempt to relieve some of the symptoms of Parkinson's.
And in his case, it did work very well. Let's hear what he says about the result.
Having pig cells in my brain has made me more of a human being rather than less. I'm more whole, I'm more complete, I can do more things that a human being should be able to do.
It's important, I think, to have a face on the technologies, you know, something like xenotransplantation, which people find very hard to imagine. Why would you ever want to be creating part human, part animal organisms? And there are very compelling medical reasons, but some people might find them objectionable.
And it does get you to the question of what does it mean to be a human?
I think all of these technologies, if we let them soak in a little bit, bring us to that question. We have opportunities in these technologies to save lives, to create families, to do all sorts of amazing things. At the same time, we are severely testing our sort of inherited wisdom about family and our relationship to each other, to other organisms in the world. And that it's, you know, it's important that we take a moment and say, what do we want to do here? These technologies, they're not our master. We can harness them in the ways that we want to. And they really touch on very deep, visceral, philosophical things. The challenge in a pluralistic society is to take advantage of those technologies and at the same time honor these deeply held beliefs of people of very different opinions and backgrounds.
Thank you, Noel.
Thank you, Gail.
Writer, producer, and director Noel Schwerin's documentary, Bloodlines, Technology Hits Home, airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Susan Laurie Parks won a Pulitzer for her Broadway play, Top Dog Underdog. But we talk with her about her new novel.
And lobster and laughs are on the menu as Chef Kathy Gunst and Car Talk's Ray Maliazzi concoct a seafood pasta delight. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Stonehenge Neckwear, makers of 100% silk ties with classic patterns designed to embody the idea of enduring excellence, available at local retailers. Mississippi's Mississippi's of Roxbury began serving Boston in Kenmore Square in 1977, and Boston Botanicals offering comprehensive interior plant service and design to businesses in Greater Boston and proprietors of a unique flower shop in downtown Boston. The WBUR online auction is underway. It's your chance to bid on hundreds of items, including a $500 gift certificate from netputting.com and an assessment and review of your company's presentation by Blackfriars Communications. Go to WBUR.org and make a bid for the news. 73 degrees in Boston right now. It's 1229.
I'm Bill Littlefield. A tradition there was that's been absent of late. It's returned to us thanks to a kind twist of fate. The Brewer's Offering is back, and I'm pleased to announce you can come sample wonderful brews by the ounce, plus games and prizes and food for your plate. Now, you won't want to miss this, so write down the date. It's happening Saturday, June 21st. Bring your appetite, friends, and a moderate thirst.
For your tickets to the Brewer's Offering and Food Expo, call 800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, North Korea says it will develop nuclear weapons as the United States announces it's pulling soldiers back from the DMZ.
And an unusual collaboration between a family theater and a gay and lesbian production company.
We do some of our shows in gay men's cruising areas in the middle of the night, you know, or bars or bathhouses. And yet, I think there's a really beautiful set of values that we have overlapping.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Three Palestinians are dead, 30 injured after Israeli tanks and helicopters fired toward a Palestinian residential area in the northern Gaza Strip today. At the same time, Palestinians fired six homemade rockets from northern Gaza into Israel.
All of this just hours after an assassination attempt on Hamas leader Abdel Aziz Rantisi. Speaking to reporters from his hospital bed, Rantisi claims Israeli attacks have the backing of President Bush. Hamas is now threatening to kill Israeli political leaders in response to the attack on Rantisi. President Bush voiced sharp criticism of Israel for the attack. The president says he is deeply troubled by the violence and warned that it will undermine Palestinian efforts to clamp down on terror. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer says Israel has a right to defend itself, but he says this attack will not contribute to Israel's security. U.S. troops continue to be attacked in almost daily skirmishes in Iraq. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says he sees no quick end to the attacks. Since the fall of Baghdad on April 9th, 39 Americans have been killed in hostile action in Iraq. Meanwhile, a U.S. military spokesman says the total number of coalition troops killed since the start of the Iraq War is now 205. Of the total number of dead, 135 were killed in hostile activities, 70 in friendly fire incidents or other accidents. Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi is said to be well and in good spirits. That's according to a UN envoy who saw her today. The leader of Myanmar's Democratic Movement was taken into captivity by Myanmar's military rulers following a violent confrontation on May 30th. The man who served Ronald Reagan as Treasury Secretary and Chief of Staff before being forced from office in the Iran-Contra scandal has died. Donald Reagan, who was forced to resign from the administration in 1987, later published a tell-all biography, which revealed that former First Lady Nancy Reagan consulted frequently with an astrologer while her husband was president. Donald Reagan was 84 years old. Thai police say they've arrested three men believed to be part of the terrorist group suspected in last year's Bali bombing that killed more than 200 people. This follows the arrest last month of an alleged senior member of a terrorist group. Officials say they foiled a plot by the terror cell to bomb embassies in Thailand. It's 33 minutes past the hour. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 59 points at 9,039. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Essex Partners, providing innovative career strategies, consulting services, and new opportunities to senior executives in transition in Boston and on the web at EssexPartners.com. TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialist. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. And the Boston Gamma Knife Center at Tufts New England Medical Center, non-surgical treatment for brain tumors, trigeminal neuralgia, and other neurologic disorders. BostonGammaKnifeCenter.org. The Red Sox open a three-game series against the St. Louis Cardinals at Fenway Park tonight. It is the first time the National League Cardinals have played at Fenway since beating the Sox in the 1967 World Series. Beautiful weather on tap for them this evening. Highs today in the upper 70s this afternoon.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
North Korea threatened yesterday to build nuclear weapons to counter what it called a hostile United States. That's the first time the country's publicly issued such a warning. The United States is also changing its position on the Korean Peninsula, announcing last week that more than 14,000 troops will be pulled back from the demilitarized zone that separates North and South Korea. We're going to look at both the military and diplomatic significance of this, beginning with defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, John Arquilla, who joins us now from Monterey, California. Hi, John.
Good to be with you, Bill.
Thanks for joining us, John. For 50 years, John, American soldiers have stared down North Korean soldiers along that heavily mined 150-mile strip of border, the demilitarized zone, the DMZ. If the threat of war with North Korea is greater now, seemingly, than in a long time, why would U.S. troops pull back?
By pulling back just a little bit, we can prevent the North Koreans from moving forward. Very simply, if we leave our forces close up to the demilitarized zone, they would be much more vulnerable to attack from the outset of any conflict. By bringing them back just a little bit, we put them in a position to begin counterattacking almost immediately. That's the curious irony of the times we're in terms of military affairs. What makes us actually more effective makes us apparently less effective.
Huh. Interesting. And it's part of a kind of radical restructuring of our military posture all over the world. Tell me what the arc of instability is and how that plays into the decision in Korea.
Well, I think this notion of an arc of instability follows the line of our deployments, really, from Northeast Asia through South Asia and around to Europe, where we're talking about moving from Germany to much smaller detachments deployed in a number of new NATO countries. The idea here is a little bit more like the Roman Empire, which for a couple of centuries really kept much smaller forces over far greater areas of deployment. They had their own arcs of instability to worry about and decided to use their legions in basically more compartmentalized detachments, and they would call them together if they had to in times of crisis. And I think that's the new idea with these hub bases that we have that would be able to provide mutual support in the event of an attack anywhere along that arc.
As we move our military around the world, changing our posture in all sorts of ways, there seems internationally, as people look at us from abroad, to be such an emphasis on military posturing from this administration. How concerned are you that this new approach could just make us seem like we're only emphasizing military solutions from this country?
I think this is a tremendous problem for the United States today. As a defense analyst, I'm pleased to see these changes that will make our military more efficient. It is curious, though, that our information and diplomatic strategies are not accompanying these changes.
John, what about North Korea? How are they reacting to the repositioning of troops in South Korea?
Well, they've expressed a great deal of public concern about this, and I think it's because they understand we're improving our military capabilities quite substantially by doing this. The North Koreans think deeply and innovatively about military affairs. They don't have all the high-tech we do, but they do interesting things with low-tech. About 10% of their million-man army is special forces, working in small detachments designed to go behind the lines and to attack at many different points simultaneously. And they don't insert by any high technological means. They're using old Antonov II biplanes, often canvas-covered, that can carry 14 to 16 troops on them and evade our radar. And so by a variety of means, they have a kind of transformed military as well. And I think they realize that when the Americans begin to work in this way with small detachments, they looked at Afghanistan, where 300 special forces toppled the Taliban from power. They know they're up against something very, very troubling. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why they want to improve their own nuclear deterrent.
John Arcola, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Bill.
John Arcola is a defense analyst at the RAND Corporation. Well, to look at the diplomatic impact, we're joined now in the studio by Sung-Yoon Lee. He's a professor of international politics at Tufts University. Thank you for coming in, Dr. Lee.
It's my pleasure.
Do South Koreans see the repositioning of U.S. troops as making military confrontation with North Korea more likely or less likely?
Many South Koreans fear exactly that, and here's the reason.
That it means more likely military confrontation.
Right. Meaning the United States and South Korea, China and Japan and so forth, the neighbors in the region in Northeast Asia, have all been hostages to North Korea over the past decades. So, in effect, the United States is sending out an ambivalent message, chiefly to North Korea, that the U.S., from this point on, will enjoy more latitude, greater latitude, and if it comes to it, take decisive action, military action against North Korea.
Now, what about other powers in the area? Does this make China, Japan, India nervous, happy?
It makes all of the above nervous, certainly. Mm-hmm. And I think...
Why? Why does it make them nervous?
Well,
what does it have to do with them in a way?
Because it escalates the crisis, the critical situation on the Korean Peninsula today. But unfortunately, again, I think this is the least unpalatable option available to the United States. But as a negotiating strategy in tandem with diplomacy and talks, and we will have further rounds of talks with North Korea in the coming months, perhaps within the next couple of months, in tandem with diplomacy and dialogue, the threat of the use of force is an effective negotiating strategy.
Do you think there's enough diplomacy emerging from Washington in relation to the North Koreans, or is there too much of an emphasis on military strategies? Our previous guest was concerned about that military strategy is fine, but without a diplomatic front as intense, it won't help.
Well, certainly the U.S. is walking a very fine line. This is international politics played at a very high level, at a very dangerous level. But such is the nature of the North Korean regime.
Let's finish with one other aspect of what the U.S. is up to on the Korean Peninsula. It's encouraging our Asian allies to inspect North Korean ships, is it not, in particular Japan?
Yes. Again, North Korea makes a lot of money, $500 million a year from the sales of missiles and missile technology, also another $500 million from the sale of opium and other illicit drugs. So I think this is beyond moral considerations, on a practical level, I think putting greater pressure on North Korea to abide by the norms of international community, to prevent North Korean sales of drugs and missiles and so forth, which are offensive weapons, of course.
How likely is it that war could break out on the Korean Peninsula, just to ask the final $64,000 question?
Well, at this point, not very likely. Even to the most hawkish hawks in D.C., a war on the Korean Peninsula is not an option. It would lead to the deaths of tens of thousands of American lives, not to mention the deaths of millions of South Korean lives.
Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us on Here and Now.
It's my pleasure.
Seong-Yoon Lee is professor of international politics at Tufts University.
Still to come, a family theater teams up with a gay and lesbian production company to present the play Bel Canto.
You're listening to Here and Now.
We know you've been busy. You drove Matthew to his soccer match and Lauren to her dance class, and then there's the gardening and the groceries and, oh, don't forget the Little League playoffs. Well, it can be difficult to find time to squeeze in a doctor's visit, and 30 to 45-year-olds are the most likely to overlook a checkup. So one hospital is taking blood pressure and cholesterol screenings out to the ballgame, just in case all those peanuts and Cracker Jacks are taking a toll on your health. Joining me on the line now is Roseanne Scripp. She is Community Outreach Director for Fairview Hospital in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Hi, Roseanne.
Hello.
Why the Little League games?
There's an age group that doesn't get to the doctors because they're taking care of their children and their parents. We decided to go to them. We decided to go to the Olympian Fields in Great Barrington and do free screenings for participants, parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles who watch their kids every night at the game.
And what was the reaction of the people that you tested last night?
Well, last night was our first night, and we saw 27 people.
Any results yet?
We have probably a third with elevated blood pressures and a third with higher cholesterols than normal. We're looking at 200 or under for desirable cholesterol range.
Now, in terms of blood pressure in particular, we know that Little League games can be very exciting. You know, sometimes people have gotten so excited that they've turned violent. And I'm wondering if there's a risk that blood pressure levels might be higher than normal anyway.
Well, it is a possibility. We managed to screen several coaches, and they were within normal limits. So I think they're doing the right thing in keeping their frustrations, anger, et cetera, under control.
You're right. That is a good sign if the coaches are okay.
Yeah.
What happens to the people that you found who did have elevated blood pressure? Is there any follow-up for them?
There's a follow-up with their private physicians. We give them a piece of paper with the normal values and the information that we screened, the numbers last night, and suggest they see their doctors. Many of them that we spoke with see doctors on a regular basis and are on medication. So we encourage them to continue to eat right, drink plenty of water, watch the salt, the hot dogs, etc. And they were grateful for additional information.
Was anyone surprised by what you found?
One individual was surprised with her cholesterol level, and we gave her a list of physicians for her to seek out so she can get a real screening. And by that I mean a fasting lipid profile.
Which is?
12 to 14-hour fast. Total cholesterol. The cholesterol is broken down with the good cholesterol, the HDL, the LDL, and a triglyceride level. Then the doctor would put that into perspective with her age, her family history, and decide, you know, what track to take with her.
So really what you were looking for last night was just some early warning signs that people would be able to follow up on their own.
That's right.
Do you think any other hospitals might follow your lead on this?
I really don't know. I haven't read of any doing this. I just know that in this community, it's hard to get that age group, so we decided to go to them.
And do you think you'll be doing it again?
Oh, yes. And then in September, I'll be off to the soccer fields in Lee.
Another place where there's a lot of stress.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Roseanne Scripp, for telling us about it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Roseanne Scripp is Community Outreach Director for Fairview Hospital in Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by New England Nurses, 20 years of personalized home health care, now offering corporate wellness flu clinics and night nannies, providing new parents with a good night's sleep, newenglandnurses.com. And Creative Catering in Somerville, providing distinctive food for any event. Catering menus are available at 617-666-4366. The WBUR online auction is underway. It's your chance to bid on hundreds of items, including a hand-knotted vegetable-dyed carpet from Moore and McPherson, and enrollment in any course at the Boston University Metropolitan College. Go to WBUR.org and make a bid for the news. Beautiful weather on tap for today. Highs near 80 degrees. It is 73 degrees in Boston. The time is 12:48.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Music by Jimi Hendrix weaves through a new play by Daniel Alexander Jones. It's called Bel Canto.
Bel Canto. Bel Canto.
Bel Canto premiered this past weekend in Boston and was written for the Theater Offensive, an activist production group devoted to edgy exploration of gay and lesbian culture. Bel Canto's script was further developed at the Sundance Institute Summer Play Lab in Utah. And playwright Jones says it's a coming-of-age story about a young African-American man named Benji.
He's 16. He's just moved with his mother from Berkeley, California, where he was born and raised, to Massachusetts, where she was born and raised, after they realized that his father, who has dodged the draft during Vietnam, is no longer with them. He's not going to be coming back after amnesty was given by Jimmy Carter. And so they come to the East Coast, where Bessie proceeds to engage a new life and set a clean slate for her and her son. And his journey is one of adjustment, a cultural adjustment, not only from California to Massachusetts, but also engaging issues of race and class and sexuality along the way.
Why'd you move here if you like it so much in Berkeley?
Not that you shouldn't have. I mean, it's great that you're here. Well, I mean, I hardly even know you at all, but, well, welcome, you know.
It's all right here. I like the snow.
Yeah?
My mom needed a change. She's enrolled in nursing school out here in Holyoke.
Wow.
It's surprising that a play sponsored by a gay and lesbian culture group is being staged at the Wheelock Family Theater, where the productions are generally geared toward moms, dads, kids, and grandparents. To find out more, producer Andrea Shea headed to the Wheelock Family Theater on opening night to talk to artistic director Susan Kosoff about this unexpected collaboration with the Theater Offensive.
Actually, Theater Offensive approached us with the idea, and we met with Abe Rybeck, who's the artistic director, and read the play and talked at some length among ourselves and decided for a number of reasons that it was a project we wanted to participate in.
And Jane Staub, the Wheelock's general manager, has her own reasons for supporting this collaboration.
First of all, the play. I think it's a beautiful play, and it speaks to a segment of the family of humanity, which is really what we're interested in doing. And specifically, it does talk about a boy who's at a point in his life where he needs direction, and it's this coming-of-age story, which is very appropriate for many of the older children that come to our theater, and certainly the adults that come with them. It's a place to start, you know, talking about issues, gay issues and coming-of-age issues. The inspiration of a teacher was very important, I think, in thinking about this play as something that would be great for our, some of our audiences. Not all of our audience, but certainly a segment of our audiences.
Your first lesson. This is a remarkable event, Benjamin. You will remember it and me with indescribable sentiment each time that velvet curtain rises and falls. Rises and falls.
I'm excited.
You should be.
I listened to Tosca again and again.
Tell me.
Oh, it was wow. I mean, I can't.
We wanted very much to do a play that was written by a person of color, directed by a person of color, with a preponderance of people of color in the cast. And the fact is that we share many underlying values with Theater Offensive. We're both small companies in Boston with, I think, a social agenda. We certainly want to do good theater, but we also are guided by our principles and our values in a way that we make explicit. We believe that theater can change people's lives, and I suspect that so does the Theater Offensive.
I'm Abe Rybeck. I'm the artistic director of the Theater Offensive, and I sure do think that theater can change people's lives. That's what our work is about. I think when the Theater Offensive started, one of the reasons we started was that we didn't want to create theater that had the agenda of justifying who we were or making some kinds of excuses for it, but rather stuff that really expressed the realities in beautiful art that was bold and broke through barriers and the kind of orthodoxy that's out there. Oh, being gay means this. We know what that means, duh. It just doesn't have to be that way.
So why did you approach the Wheelock Theater with Bel Canto?
You know, when I'm looking for good collaborators, what I've noticed over the years is that you have to look for people who have underlying values that you really share and are important to you, but a different set of resources so that you have something to offer each other instead of just more of the same. And what I thought was so beautiful when I would come here as a theater goer or when I would talk with the folks who worked here was that they had taken such a beautiful approach to doing work with families that I thought at heart expressed so much of what the Theater Offensive was trying to do in a completely different setting. I mean, we do some of our shows in gay men's cruising areas in the middle of the night, you know, or bars or bathhouses. And yet, I think there's a really beautiful set of values that we have overlapping. For instance, their work is really about the rich diversity of young people's lives and families' lives. And I think that our work is much more about a sense of family or redefining the constricted orthodox definitions of family that are out there. And I think the Wheelock Family Theater has always been experimenting with that as well.
And the birds calling, look! Calling, look! Calling, look!
Look,
God, look at the love you've made glinting out of those two silly springs in the palm of your hand. And the sidelong
rush
of blue light falling off your lips.
Bel Canto really challenges people's notion of what it is to be an American in this era. And it really claims America for the broad diversity of people who are here and who make this country all the beautiful things that it is.
My name is Daniel Alexander Jones, and I'm the playwright. Bel Canto is an epic love story set in late 1970s Western Massachusetts, and it follows the journey of central character Benjamin Turner as he encounters love, deals with longing and loss in a highly operatic context.
And tears are withdrawn, and floods that drown with sorrow.
opera is an element in the world of the play, and the play was structured. I wrote the play with an eye, or an ear, I should say, toward musical structures in opera and also out of jazz music.
Fuoco! Fuoco! Fuoco!
So what do you think about this collaboration between the Wheelock Family Theater and the Theater Offensive? Do you find it to be unusual, or do you think it works?
I think it's right in the heart, in the spirit of the play. This play is a play about collaboration. Its central characters collaborate with one another on their journeys, and to see Wheelock and Theater Offensive collaborate feels just right.
Bel Canto playwright Daniel Alexander Jones. Producer Andrea Shea also spoke with Abe Rybeck, artistic director of the Theater Offensive, and Susan Kosoff and Jane Staub of the Wheelock Family Theater. For more information on Bel Canto and the theater groups, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young returns tomorrow.
And thanks for filling in, Gail.
My pleasure, Bill.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.